Thank you all. And we thought we would have a conversation here, and everyone here, by the way, we'd have a conversation here and then bring you all into it. We are blessed with an extraordinary group of talented people, women and men, here today. Madeleine Albright, you all know, Secretary of State, professor, head of the Albright Group, diplomat, scholar, activist. John Dickinson, former White House correspondent, writer for Slate, an amazing journalist who brings years and years of experience in covering politics. Jane Harman, you know, of course, Jane Harman, the representative from California, who has been a leader on intelligence, homeland security, and long experience in politics and the law. Senator Feinstein from California on intelligence, judiciary, homeland security, the chair of the Rules Committee. Margaret Spellings, our education secretary, and the spark plug behind No Child Left Behind. All of you have great experience with the subject of women in politics and with women in public life. And in looking at this year's election, we look back to 2004, and women were a majority of the voters in the Democratic primaries in the early states of New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Iowa caucuses. So women are playing an increasingly important role. Obviously, this year, with the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, we are seeing a really strong focus on women as a political issue. But we thought we would start today by talking about how hard it has been for the people on this panel to strike out in their own careers and talk a bit about personal stories. Jane, do you want to start?
I guess this was my idea, yes, I'd be happy to start. When we think about women, by the way, I was looking at the Breyer family and thinking what a difference it makes that Sandra Day O'Connor has left the Supreme Court and now we have Sam Alito. Just think about that. Personal stories. Everybody here broke a number of glass ceilings. Andrea certainly did. I read your book, and I loved your book. And as a Penn parent, I realize what a pioneer you were when you were a Penn student many years ago and the first woman on the radio station, and you know the rest is history. But in my case, I went to the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles in 1960 as a high school kid, and I saw John Kennedy nominated for president. And I was an usher at his acceptance speech, and my personal light bulb went off. And 30 years later, I ran for Congress, the first political office I had ever attempted, and was elected in a lean Republican seat as a moderate Democrat. And I faced some tough races. But the reason I'm telling this story is that all along the way, at least for me, trying the decision to go to law school from a women's college, Smith College. Smith didn't offer the law boards. Had to go to Amherst to take the law boards. Went to law school, went to Harvard Law School in a small group of women at the time. This was truly the dark ages. My graduating year was the first year that Harvard required law firms that interviewed students on campus to interview women as well as men. Guess what happened? Women got hired. Imagine, miracle of miracles. And now they're more than 50% in law schools and law firms. But all along the way, the first senior aide to a California senator who was a female to a California senator who, of course, was male. But I was there watching the change in composition in the Senate and the House in 1992 when I was elected, and Diane was also, the so-called year of the woman. The number of women in the House doubled. Literally doubled, but it was 13 and then it went to 25. That was the year of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. No one can forget that. And then in 94, the Gingrich revolution, most of those women, or many of them, elected like me in these so-called marginal seats that could have gone either way, lost because there was this huge Republican tsunami. And in my case, I remained, but I was my margin of victory was 800 votes out of 225,000 cast. So it's been a long road. The point I'd like to make is now that I have some real seniority and I chair an intelligence subcommittee in the House, is that women are qualified to serve in any position in this country, anywhere, anytime. And it is really, by my lights, affirming to see how many talented women are in every single room, every time there is a meeting in the House of Representatives, whether they chair committees or they're new or they're whatever they are in either party. Women are problem solvers. I think we come to figure out what the answers are, not just to point fingers at the other guy. And my suggestion is that when we have a woman in the White House, which may be this time, maybe soon, people will pinch themselves and say, why did it take so long? Why didn't we understand so many years earlier that the skill sets that women bring are so incredibly useful in such a dangerous and changing world?
Margaret Spellings, there have been more women in important roles in this administration than in many previous administrations. I can't recall a White House that had more women close advisors to the president, from Condi Rice to Karen Hughes to yourself to Harriet Myers. I mean, a small group of people, many of them from Texas, which is counterintuitive to a lot of Democratic women who think that Republican administrations don't reach out to women. What is the balance of power, and what is the particular experience that you've had as a woman in Texas attached to this presidency and dealing with all of the issues that you have seen from inside the White House and now in the Education Department?
Well, I think you're right to point out that it's a longstanding relationship, and there's a trust and a candor there that you know is very fundamental. And you know, I'm proud of that. Obviously, I mean, the president. I mean, people who have psychoanalyzed it. Mrs. Bush used to say, when I was the domestic policy advisor and Condi was the national security advisor, that I was in charge of everything domestic and she was in charge of everything foreign, and that seemed about right to her. So we did have influential positions, but I think it's also about the ability to talk to the president or talk to your principal in a way that is honest and candid and unvarnished. And so I think, you know, that obviously builds up over time.
Madeleine Albright, we remember back when you were first announced for the cabinet in 1996. The cabinet members were all brought out on the stage, and one of them, the Commerce Secretary, fainted. If it had been one of the women cabinet secretaries who had fainted, what would have been the response?
Well, I think the response would have been, she's weak, she can't stand up under pressure, she's menopausal, or any number of things like that. I was just very grateful that I didn't faint. And I remember there was one particular speech I was giving on the Middle East that, in fact, had been worked on till the last minute. And as I was giving it, I thought, I hope the pages are in the right order. And then I got more nervous. And then I thought, I'm going to faint. And then I thought, if I faint, it's curtains. It's over. So I think that it's just an example of things that women cannot do that men actually can get away with. I think that a woman cannot cry, whereas now it's a sign of great sympathy or empathy if a male office holder or candidate cries.
I mean, it was fatal to Pat Schroeder, but it was also pretty damaging to Ed Muskie.
Well, I was working for, that was then, but I think
probably
now.
Probably not tears, it was probably a snowflake. Well, we don't know.
Well, I worked for him, it was snow, I can tell you. And David Broder, who wrote the story with tears streaming down his face, says it was wrong. I feel very personal about this one. Yeah. But I do think what is interesting is discussions even today where President Bush chokes up or President Clinton chokes up, yeah, and people think that's kind of neat, whereas if a woman gets wobbly, it's very bad. And I think it's just one of the things. When I wrote my memoirs, I had in a preface of it that basically the same adjectives, different adjectives are applied to the same characteristics. A woman is aggressive, a man is bold, a woman is emotional, a man is sensitive. It doesn't matter what it is, and I think that is one of the really difficult parts, because in order to be in any one of our jobs, I think that there does have to be a certain fortitude and a way of not looking as if you're going to fold under the worst pressure. Whereas on a man, it kind of looks like he gets it. And it's very difficult. And there's no question that we are judged on a different scale than others. You brought up a musky thing, and I just have to start the story. Because I I had done fundraising for Muskie, but then I went on a staff, and I was his chief legislative assistant, it was called at that time. And then I went to the White House, and Senator Muskie was not happy when I went to work for the Carter administration. And he was a very old-fashioned man and didn't have the vocabulary down.
What does old-fashioned mean?
Well, meaning that women had their roles, despite the fact that I was...
I thought you were speaking in code. That's what
No. And very interesting in terms of who his advisors were and how things worked. So finally, he said to me, well, you know, a woman can't do congressional relations, which was the job I was being hired for. That made me crazy, and I thought, okay, I don't have a problem leaving if that's how he feels about it. And then he got up. They were giving a party for me. And he gets up, and he looks around his staff, and he said, I'm so sorry Madeline's leaving. She's just been fabulous. And she was the first person to give sex to the office. And I said, gender.
Was it a large office?
Yeah. Anyway, the vocabulary and stuff was a little
Save me, John.
Yes. Well, I'm reminded of our current president who talked about OBGYNs who practice their love on their patients. I feel a little bit like Admiral Stockdale, Ross Perot's vice presidential candidate, who went into the debates and said, who am I and why am I here? But I think there's
affirmative action.
Yes, that's right.
Not anymore.
No, I think there's a nice piece of historical karma here. I should mention I'm the son of a woman named Nancy Dickerson, who was the first woman news correspondent for CBS News,
and a great role model to everyone here, everyone in my business.
That's right, and they didn't let women do that kind of thing back then. And she spent much of her career on stages or in rooms full of men as the only woman. So it's nice that it's flipped here and that I'm the only man up here. I'm going to tell my own little tiny glass ceiling breaking story, which was that 39 years ago, yesterday, my mother was on TV and the next day she wasn't. And Robert Goralski went on air and said, Nancy Dickerson will be out for a couple weeks because she's just had a child. This shocked her viewers because they didn't know she was pregnant. She had been shot always from about here up because nobody wanted to let anybody know. It was bad enough she was a woman presenting the news. That was controversial enough. But they didn't want a lot of blatant womanhood with pregnancy. And so I was hidden under the desk for...
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you. So that's my glass ceiling story.
Well, it was... Looking at the coverage this week from Iowa, and we're anticipating another joint appearance in New Hampshire, and this has been carefully structured by the Clinton campaign. Let me ask you about the role of Bill Clinton as campaign partner, first spouse. I mean, you've covered so many campaigns. This is pretty extraordinary, the way in the first rally he was sitting on the hay bale, then there was a stool, how to get him off stage. I mean, they have spent hours looking at how to choreograph this. So clearly they are concerned about the optics.
Very concerned. It's hard to disaggregate, to use a phrase from Bush education policy, the issues here. Because one is you have a woman president and a presidential candidate, and that's one issue. Then you have a very popular within the Democratic Party, also controversial within the other party, former president on stage. And so it's hard to know what they're balancing here. Is it just a question of one spouse overshadowing another, which you could flip the genders and make a case where the woman might overshadow the man? It often is the case. The Dole campaign in 96 had issues and questions about now Senator Dole, Elizabeth Dole, overshadowing her husband so much more appealing than he was. Now, of course, they used that famously in the convention where she did a kind of Oprah-style walk-around. But so that's an issue for both sides. I think the real challenge for Hillary Clinton, she's making a clear appeal to women, and it's why she outpolls among women in the polls so far her closest competitor, Barack Obama, by 2-1. It is the reason she has this advantage. She has a stronger advantage with women who have no college education than women who do. And she's making a real appeal to women, and specifically women who have not voted a lot before, what they call women of needs, which is women who only got college education, tend to be lower income, and that's where she's making the appeal. Of course, the problem that's already been discussed up here and that's been lived by everyone up here is that if you play too hard for the woman's vote and play the woman's card, then you have all of these other problems that Secretary Albright mentioned, questions about toughness, and also you get a potential backlash among male voters who see the Hillary candidacy merely as a woman thing. So it's this incredible tightrope. I should mention as a concluding remark that Barack Obama has the same problem with the African-American vote. A lot of people felt that Hillary Clinton gave a more appealing presentation to the African-American community in the last debate because she could. Obama might have been seen, some people say, as kind of pandering too much. So he has to walk a similar tightrope with that constituency.
Interestingly, after the South Carolina debate, and Hillary Clinton has done very well by all accounts in the Democratic debates. It's where she has really punched through. Barack Obama has had this extraordinary, you know, fundraising ability and ability to bring new people in, and 250,000 contributors, individual contributors, is an amazing number so far after the two quarters of fundraising. But Hillary Clinton has been very, very crisp and experienced in the debate format. Coming out of the South Carolina debate, I was on the air with a group, and Pat Buchanan's was one of the people involved. And Pat Buchanan's comment was, she has just passed the commander-in-chief test. She has proved that she is the strongest of the Democrats on foreign policy and has passed that threshold. Let me ask you, as a Republican, Secretary Spellings, whether you think women, I mean, Condi Rice and other women whom you've worked with in politics, have a tougher time passing that test, or do they have to go through certain contortions to try to diminish the female side of their personalities? You know, is there a different standard?
I think they do, and I think it's, you know, smart management, and she can do it. I mean, she certainly has proved that she knows how to strike that balance. I think she's been very, very effective. But I also think, to John's point, that Barack Obama has to overcome the state senator label and so forth. So I don't think it's limited just to women. I think it's about age and experience and gravitas and how you handle yourself in tough situations, which she has proved over and over again that she can do, et cetera. So I think it's in part about that, but not only.
And Senator, is there a double standard still at your level, or when you reach your level of seniority, you know, on, you know, fields such as intelligence and judiciary?
The answer, in my view, is very clearly yes. And I think people have to look back into how this nation began. We just went through the 4th of July. Women didn't get the vote to 1920. Women couldn't own property. Women couldn't go to many schools. Women have had to fight for everything they have received in this great democracy. And there still are deep-seated prejudices and biases that underlay the American electorate when it comes to electing women. I've been at this, I think, longer than anyone up here. I remember 1969 when I first ran. Women did not support other women. There was a kind of jealousy, an envy. I heard many people say under their breath, something must be wrong with her marriage. And that's why I was running for the Board of Supervisors at the time. Then in 1990, running for governor of California, I remember addressing the wives of something called YPO, the Young Presidents Organization. These were wives of men who were presidents of corporations and I think under 39 years of age. And they liked what I had to say, and the end came and said, what can we do to help you? And I said, you can contribute to my campaign. And they said almost to a person, we'll go home and talk to our husbands about it. So women asked their husband, to a great extent, women still do. The major donors still, in my campaigns, and I've had 15 of them, essentially are men. And yet today, I get a substantial vote from women, more than men. Having said that, in my view, women have to work for and earn everything they get along the way. Nothing is given to them. They have to be better prepared in a press conference, because if you're new, the press are going to press the question just to see how much you know. So you don't dare not do your homework virtually every step of the way. Now, with respect to Hillary and all of the things that were just said, I think she still has a major job cut out for her, because she's going to have to take what is a long-standing concept that women are not as strong as. We know that in many respects physically, but women are not as strong as in other respects. Determination, motivation, drive, staying power, those things that are ephemeral that really determine an individual's long-term effectiveness. And the bottom line is effectiveness. So I think, despite what the poll numbers say, what's going to carry her is essentially the vision thing and the kind of America she is going to provide as the leader of this nation should she get there. And whether a majority, a strong, strong majority, dominant of women, are willing to say, this is really what I want. And I would submit that if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, she does so by a substantial gender gap, because I think where she'll enjoy very strong male support, it will not nearly equal the female support. I think today women are supportive of other women. Women are proud of other women. Women are willing, to the extent they can, to contribute to women. And women have a sense of what the world should be. And it's not, to a great extent, the same sense in terms of the use of power. And I think that's going to be how she's going to say she's going to use power is really, I think, going to be a very compelling feature in this election.
I just wanted to add to that. One of the, I think, Hillary Clinton's strongest selling points is that she is an excellent senator. Dianne Feinstein has been an excellent senator much longer. But women do excel in senior political roles, and it's on display all the time. And I just would hope, in all this stuff about is Bill upstaging Hill and where's the chair and what color yellow did she wear and, you know, what did her hair look like?
That was his color yellow.
Oh, it was his color yellow. Excuse me, I misread it. I would just hope that she, I don't know what exact role he should play or not, and I do think that his popularity is testament to the fact that his presidency was a very impressive presidency. But putting that aside, she should talk about her life and her view of the issues, which she, by herself, has demonstrated she has a huge grasp of. And I think that that will impress everybody. And, you know, as a comment about, is she strong enough to be commander-in-chief? I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt that Madeline is strong enough to be commander-in-chief. Diane is strong enough to be commander-in-chief. I don't know Margaret as well, but let's go there. Lots of, certainly Andrea, my God, could be, you know, take on anything.
Secretary of the Army.
No, that's not as strong, it's not as a senior position, but women have arrived. We can do these things. We do have the experience to do these things, and we can take the tough decisions. We all have done that, and also have a human side. I don't mean that men don't, but everyone up here has family stories to tell. Sidney Harmon has arrived. Imagine, here he is. And I've always said that being married to Sidney is much harder than being in politics.
Well, just testimony to some of the data that John mentioned, and that
you were mentioning as well about the gender gap. When John mentioned that the gender gap right now in the polling, in the Washington Post polling in April, which polled deeply, drilled down on the women's issue, was 2-1 Hillary over Obama, and that her real advantage, her 15-point lead over Obama, was largely because of this gender gap. 51% of Democrats and Democrat-leaning independents were supporting Hillary, over 24% supporting Obama. And as you mentioned, the differential on college graduates versus high school graduates, it was that women of need, women who had less education and more reliance on the social safety net, responded more to Hillary than the better educated women. These are just the sort of responses. I did a focus group that we put together outside of Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago, and it was really interesting to see that the one Republican swing voter that we had in this very small group said that she was, if she didn't want to vote for a Republican so far, is what she saw. The war was the big issue for her. She could vote for Obama, but not Hillary. What offended her, and they got into quite an argument about this, was what she interpreted as Hillary's aggressiveness, what the other women said was her strength and her virtue. And again, this gets to this sort of subtext of how what Madeline was describing as, you know, good attributes to some are described as negative when they are attached to women. John, do you think that it's the way we in the press focus on these things?
You use different adverbs for women than you do with men. Let me just say that. I'm out of order.
Please.
Let me just say that.
Jump in.
A woman complains. A man states that he, you know.
A woman whines.
A woman, you, I mean, I watch it over and over and over again. There are different adverbs applied to women.
Can I also make
Please.
A statement? I mean, yeah. What was interesting, when my name was up for being Secretary of State, people said that there was no way that I could deal with foreign governments, particularly Muslims. As it turned out, I had no problems at all having arrived in a large plane that said United States of America. And frankly, it's because I was representing the United States and they knew they had to deal with me. I had more problems with the men in our own government. Not because they were all male chauvinist pigs, but because they had seen me come up the ladder. And I was a friend of their wife's, or I'd been a carpool mother, or I'd been a staffer, and I was really good at making coffee and various things. And I know they were thinking, and they said it, how come she's Secretary of State when I could be Secretary of State? And the truth is that you think that it'll all be over once you have the job. It is not. And I think that's the hard part that you deal with, is that even though you actually do things, and I was probably tougher than most of the men in our administration. And I was the one that, obviously President Clinton was the one that made the decisions, but who decided that we would use force in Kosovo in order to save people from ethnic cleansing. And it was the men who were not quite sure whether we should do this. And my hardest part was actually when I was UN ambassador and General Powell, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and I felt very strongly that we were missing the boat on Bosnia. I was in New York, I heard all the time, and I argued for going and using force in Bosnia, and the various other men at the table said, don't be so emotional, Madeline. General Powell said, you know, Madeline, you don't understand what the military does. I say this because, you know, he wrote about it, so I feel comfortable
talking. Didn't he write something about...
He said, I practically gave him an aneurysm in suggesting that we use force in Bosnia, and that he had to patiently explain to Ambassador Albright what our troops are really for. I was just a mere mortal female civilian dealing with the hero of the Western world, who, frankly, I love Colin Powell, and we're great friends, but he would come into meetings in full military uniform with tons of medals and ribbons. I just had a little pin on, and so they got bigger. They got bigger. They got bigger.
They got bigger.
But there really was this kind of, you know, what is she talking about? So he writes the book. He had already left office. As we all know, it takes a little longer to get a book printed than when you've written it. And we had used force after he left, and we had won. And so the press was asking about it. So I called Colin, and I said, Colin, patiently? And he said, yeah, I did have to explain to you patiently. You didn't have a clue what you were talking about. So he then sends me his book, and he writes it with love, admiration, etc., and signs it patiently, Colin. So I sent him back a note, and I thanked him with love, admiration, etc., and I said, forcefully, Madeline.
I seem to recall during the Bosnia debate, internal debate in the cabinet, you at one point saying to Colin, Colin, why do we have this great military if we're not going to use
it? And we, the truth is that a woman, to a great extent, who has not served, and men who have not served, do have a disadvantage in talking to the military. That is true of our current president and our former president, and it is going to be a problem with the next president, because there are very few that have actually served. But I think there is a way to show a commanding presence, but it is hard. I don't think any of us can deny that it's hard. We've made it, but it's not easy. And the part for me that was the weirdest was that having become Secretary of State, and if I may say so frankly, with a lot of support from Hillary Clinton, and then confidence of the President of the United States, every single day I still had to prove to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, and all the assorted male people around, that I could do the job. And I'm sure Condi has exactly the same issue. It is not something that is solved the day that you're elected senator or member of Congress or Secretary of Education. It is something that, or a major correspondent. It is something that goes on all the time, and I think we have to deal with it in a way of knowing that it's never over. And Diane, you talked about what a battle it's been. The thing that drives me crazy, if I may say so, the younger women who think it's easy. It is not easy, and it slides backwards so easily. And that's where I think we need to remember that we still need to continue to support each other because the fight is far from over.
Well, one of the things that is so really painful as a woman, I've done a number of interviews with Sandra Day O'Connor when she was on the court and when she was off the court, and in her comments about the importance of having at least two of them and seeing the strength and I think loneliness and anger now of her one woman on the court in her dissents and in some of her other comments, it really is striking that there is, you know, Jane talks about 50% of the women out of law schools and in law firms being 50% of the lawyers being women now, and to have one woman on the Supreme Court is...
Well, Diane, you had dinners, actually, of the women senators that I would come and meet with.
That's
it
right.
It made a big difference.
Yeah, I think it did make a big difference. I think for us, well, at this time, this was several years ago, and Madeline came, and I think at that time we were 9 women in the Senate. We're now 17, but 9. And we sat together and we looked around the table, and here's the Secretary of State, and here are women senators. And it was interesting what the conversation was, because it was a high-level conversation, I think. And yet we had an opportunity to stop and laugh and kind of identify together as women. This is a lonely arena for most of us. We work very long hours, and you don't really know who you can trust to let your hair down in Washington. So one tends to be fairly guarded. And I thought there were wonderful, unguarded, and very privileged moments at that dinner, Madeline.
If I could just speak to that, too. There is a community of women in Washington. Many of us are in elected office. Some have been in appointed office. Some newsies in the group. But it is a very supportive community.
That's right.
And that happens outside of Washington, too. It is a bipartisan community. The Women's Caucus in the House is bipartisan. Just imagine. There are 70 women in the House. I'm not sure every woman belongs to it. But it is a place of sanity in a toxic sea where women can actually talk to each other, work on things together, but also enjoy downtime together and talk about the family stories we all have. I was remembering, Madeline and I were in a carpool when we were Senate staffers, just imagine, 1,000 years ago, and we both had little kids, and how life has progressed to now. We're both grannies, which is a wonderful occupation. I recommend it highly. But the stories started then, and I'm very proud of the fact that my group of friends is this accomplished group of people, not because they're accomplished, but I'm proud of their achievements. Women should not be threatened by the achievements of other women. It's a great thing when more and more women are qualified and competent. And we will celebrate a woman president, I hope in my lifetime, certainly in the lifetime of some of you. It's the right thing to happen in this country. We're a majority of the population, a majority of the talent pool, and we are qualified to do this.
Please come on. I agree with all of this that's been said about how hard it is. It is. But I also want to say that I do think that there are some advantages. And I want to also first stipulate that I am in a space that is considered to be the woman space in education, not national security. And uniquely, as a Republican, that, you know, we were the first people that showed up and cared that much about education, if I do modestly say that. The so-called different kind of Republican and so forth, and have had a more vigorous role than most Republicans talking about abolishing the department and so forth. So I know my universe is a little different. But I find I can and do say things to my colleagues and to the president in a way that is passionate, emotional, and sometimes shames them, if you will. I think that's something that we can do that's more compelling about, you know, you talked about saving lives in Kosovo, humanitarian issues and so forth. And I think women do that effectively and compellingly. And I mean, I can silence a group of male hardliners pretty quickly if I've got my act together. I'm not trying to minimize how prepared you have to be. But I do think there are some advantages, and there are some skills, and there are some nuance, and it's not all dour and dire.
And one thing that occurs to me is also just to make one counterpoint with, in having covered Secretary Albright around the world, and I can attest to the fact that when that plane landed at the first Gulf States conference, right, and you marched down the steps, you represented the United States of America in a very, very strong and forceful way, and people paid attention. But the one thing that you can say about gender is that it really is the way you use power.
That's right.
That whether you're a man or a woman, having covered Secretary Powell and Secretary Rice, there is a big difference in the way they are received in different capitals, because once the hardliners in Bush 43 first term, once they marginalized Secretary Powell in the Middle East in particular, and on one pretty embarrassing occasion, we were in Ariel Sharon's backyard waiting for a press conference, and Ari Fleischer announced a new Middle East policy from the White House briefing room just as Powell was about to try to put some wood to Sharon on settlements policy and had to back down when he walked out not having known about it. And we, of course, were getting the messages that this had just happened. So there was a marginalization of Colin Powell in those 4 years, which many people felt was really unfortunate. And the one thing that, among others, that Condi Rice brings to her job is access to the Oval Office. People, foreign leaders, know when she arrives that she is speaking for this president. Now, they respond to her based on their attitude towards the Oval Office, but they know that they don't have to go around the Secretary of State and work through the Vice President or someone else to really understand Bush policy. And so it's not always gender. It's power and how you use it and access. John, in covering politics, how has the press corps changed over the years in terms of gender? I remember, you know, the Timothy Krause book, Boys on the Bus, the carousing of the 72 campaign when there were just a handful of women, a lot of drinking, and then Cokie Roberts and others of us who joined the press corps in subsequent years, the late, great Anne Devroy from the Washington Post, we bonded together, and some people suggest that that changed the whole nature of political reporting and made it a lot more straight-laced and boring.
Oh, don't know. I could name, and I won't. The women who are in the press corps now who make it anything but straight-laced and boring. A couple of interesting historical. At the 1960 convention, where my mother was the only woman at the time, they were all waiting outside of LBJ's room, waiting for him to issue his statement about his view on the fact that John Kennedy had just gotten the nomination. It was a hallway full of men at the Biltmore Hotel, and there were two women, my mother and a reporter for Life magazine, and the majority leader saw these two women and thought, well, this isn't good for them to be just kind of leaning against the wall in the hallway, so he invited them into the parlor. Well, the men who had been in the hallway waiting to find out what the majority leader was going to say lost it, and this caused quite a ruckus because the majority leader, who still didn't say what his view was, said, oh, quiet, boys, you know, I'm just offering them a seat. But this, there was a lot of tension here, of course, because why, if the woman wants to be treated like a man, is she getting a seat? About a half an hour later, just to prove how, if this was an advantage, it was a teeny one, Walter Cronkite is on the air for CBS, and he's vamping because they don't know what Johnson's going to say. And he's got the earpiece, and he's saying, you know, we're waiting to get word from the majority leader. He's gone to bed. He's in his pajamas. And now we switch to Nancy Dickerson, who is covering him. Now, television was new, so, you know, across America, they thought they would see quite a picture indeed. Anyway, that's... And of course, my mother had to deal with a lot of rumors, which when you're the only woman and you have access and you break stories, every time you break a story, particularly with Johnson when he was president, immediately everybody thought, well, we know why she got the story. So at your moment of highest achievement, this would be the rap against you. And of course, the rap was most ardently peddled by your male competitors. So there are times when, particularly when I was in the White House press corps, surrounded by women covering the White House for the major papers, for the other news magazines, and for the networks, that that I do, you know, that it's just wonderful to see how that's really, there's some of it, you know, and there's lots of the things that have been talked about here. I won't deny that at all in terms of the way women reporters behave and the way they get categorized. But it's nice to see that it's changed at least a little bit. From the way it was in the 60s.
I would like to pick up on something that Secretary Spelling said, because I do think that there are a lot of advantages to being a woman in these jobs. And in my case, certainly in dealings with foreigners, because, and I think that Dr. Rice probably has the same issues, which is that it is possible to create better friendships and understandings. And also, there's a little bit the possibility of switching signals better. I mean, I don't know how she operates, but I basically was very nice and charming and friendly and asked kind of human questions. And then I'd say, I had the standard phrase, I have come a long way, so I must be frank. And then you could move from one to the other. And I do think, I mean, short of one thing, I used everything I had. So, you know, it was basically, I did it when I was at the UN, and I did it as secretary, because, and as a result of that, I continue to have very close friendships with still a lot of current foreign ministers and a lot of former foreign ministers who, in fact, remember the personal aspect of it that I do think men have more problems with.
Let me tell a tale out of school with your forgiveness, because when you became Secretary of State, the State Department was still really an all-boy network. And you and I talked about that before you took office. Mm-hmm. And we did a quick interview the day that Madeleine Albright was sworn in. And I did a profile of you for the Nightly News, which I kind of liked. I thought it was quite important. It was the first woman Secretary of State. And I had known you before, and you know, thought we brought something to the table. And you at the time had an assistant secretary for public affairs. And you had a little reception for everyone afterwards upstairs at the State Department after the news, after the swearing in, when the day was over. And one of the things that I had mentioned was that the new Secretary of State was going to shake up the old-boy network. And this was a State Department that still would not let two Foreign Service officers who were qualified, you know, be ambassadors at the same time, and married people had tremendous disincentives at the time. So there was a lot of built-in discrimination in the Foreign Service. And so that was one line in this piece. And afterwards, at this little reception, the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs came up to me and took great umbrage at that line in my piece and said, you know, I don't know whom you talked to about the discrimination at the State Department, but that certainly hasn't happened, and it hasn't been like that for years. And, you know, I didn't want to tell him that his new boss was my source for one of those insights. But that was, it's not just in politics. It's in all aspects of, those of you in private business know this, and as well in, you know, the media, in government, there are certain built-in assumptions about career ladders. I've certainly experienced it, and I know you did, and there is something very different about seeing a woman Secretary of Education, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Senator, Congresswoman. It sends a signal when they are as talented as the people up here are and others of their like. It sends an important signal to boys and girls about possibilities. And that is one of the things that I think, one of the values that I think attaches to having more people, a more diverse population, you know, anchor people, whatever, people who publicly can project possibilities to a younger generation.
It's also an obligation that we have to mentor and support
absolutely
younger women coming after us. It is absolutely critical that we do it, because it's, as Diane said, a cold and lonely place out there. And there are obstacles they face, and they may make different choices. My own daughters are making different choices. We have a daughter that whom I call the Auntie Jane. She doesn't read newspapers, or she claims not to. And then she gets upset when she hasn't been told that I'm on some television program. And I said, but honey, you'd never watch it. And she says, yeah, but all my friends do, and now you've embarrassed me because I didn't know. But at any rate, she, in spite of that, she's, you know, a very capable, wonderful woman, but she's making different career choices. I respect that. But lots of women and men, younger, want to make these career choices. And we have to help them make those choices. And we have to explain that maybe you can't have it all at once, but you can have it all if you organize yourself well. And yes, you can have a marriage and a family. And yes, you can have friends and a little bit of a life. But yes, you can have a powerful career. And all of that can be done. And if we don't make that clear, we're not exercising our power responsibly, in my view.
I'd like to open it up to questions from the audience. There are two microphones I see on either side, so just line up and we'll start right over there. Thank you. Are they on? Yeah, I think so.
Good morning. I'm Shelley Porges from Bethesda, Maryland, formerly from San Francisco, so you were my senator until about 2 years ago. The next president of the United States is going to have some daunting, both domestic and international problems to face. How could a woman be particularly prepared for that? And, you know, what kind of capabilities? And we've talked about a lot of things this morning, but, you know, what do you see, given the very specific kinds of issues that the next president of the United States is going to face?
Senator?
Well, I think this, when you say how can a woman, it's hard to be general now because there is one woman, and it is Hillary Clinton. If you notice some things about her, she dresses for strength. She wears a great deal of black. She has a unified body image. She holds herself very strongly. She is very good at interacting with people. She will have a very good team. My biggest hope is, if the president is Hillary, that she works across the aisle. I think that the greatest deficit in Washington is the partisanship. And the likelihood of, see, anything can get stopped in the Senate, no matter what it is, if you don't have 60 votes. because anything controversial requires 60 votes to cut off debate. Therefore, if we have, as we do, let's say 49 votes on Iraq, the Democrats do, it's a real problem unless you have 11 Republicans, because you know it's going to go to cloture and therefore require the 60 votes. Ergo, working across the party line is important. Secondly, I think listening to what the Congress has to say, genuinely wanting to know. If you come from the body, you have a much greater opportunity and instinct to work with the body than if you come from outside the body. So that also can be an asset. If she's got a dominant proportion, or even if she's got 20 on either side of the aisle on a given program she wants to push, if it's healthcare reform, she has a real advantage if she goes into something with bipartisan support. Where it becomes very tricky is when you go into something just with your own party support. That's my experience after 15 years there. And I hope that despite the fact that these elections have become so bitter, so partisan, and now with the Supreme Court's latest opinion, which will allow attack ads in the last 60 days with a lot of billions of dollars of an individual can be put into a single attack, I think this is going to be a very difficult presidential campaign. I hope if she is to win that she comes out of this campaign with that willingness to throw aside the partisanship and work with the other side of the aisle. I think that will make a huge difference in the kind of president a woman can be.
Thank you.
Yes, very good. Evelyn Canvin from New York City. I was hoping that some of you could comment on a phenomenon that I've noticed among the young women in my own family. Not so much the anti-Jane type phenomenon, but young women who are highly educated, achieved very, had very successful careers, married a little later in their 30s, and then chose to take, you know, what's called the mommy track, or actually not even the mommy track, but become full-time mothers. And while I totally respect that in my own family as well as, you know, out in our country, I fear, as somebody who fought very hard to achieve something in the corporate world, that women will be taken less seriously because we're seeing more and more of this. And I say it from a very difficult position because I totally understand the personal choices.
Could I speak to that? As we have all said, we all worked very hard to get where we are, and we have to work hard every single day, and none of it comes easily, or very little of it. And that may be true of some men, too, but it is certainly true, I think, for all the women up here. I gave up things to get here. I know I did. I mean, I didn't give up having four kids. I didn't give up loving them dearly, but I gave up a lot of time with them that I'm sad I had to give up. I am determined not to do that with grandchildren, no matter what. But I watch, I have a son and daughter who may be interesting in this way. The daughter is a lawyer who was working 18 hours a day as an associate in a New York law firm, became pregnant and said, this is ridiculous, I'm not doing this, and now has a much less demanding job as a lawyer, but it's a 9-to-5 job essentially, which permits her to live the life she chooses. I don't know where she goes after that. She's extremely bright. But I have to, my view is, I have to respect that. I think that she will have in her life some things I gave up. And that's one. But the other comment that maybe helps is a son that I have, who is married to a high-powered woman, and they are expecting a child soon, wants to cut his own hours down so that he can enjoy young fatherhood. So I can see the whole society adjusting in ways that were not possible when we were younger. When I was pregnant and working as a Senate staffer, had two kids then, didn't take a day, I mean, kids born on Sunday, back to work on Thursday, no kidding, just terrified that I'd get off the track. And maybe we can't visualize a world that will be a much more nurturing world, which we have to get to. Kids can't grow up with no support systems. Everybody gets that. You can't hire mommies. You can hire help, but you can't hire mommies. And so I actually can imagine that in my daughter's lifetime, there will be high-powered careers for women that are better careers in terms of fitting it all in than we had.
Except not everybody has the drive and the staying power. And I think that's what's coming out. And also, they don't have the economic necessity, or they do have the economic necessity. If you have an economic necessity, you have to work, period. I mean, all the rest of it doesn't make any difference. But for somebody that's a Harvard graduate, let's say, and gets good grades, the next thing is, does she really have that drive to want to say, the next 30 years of my life, I'm going to give up a lot of things to learn everything I can about X, to take the beating that you take in an election, to go through losses and come back to fight another day? This isn't right for every woman in that sense. It just isn't. And the key is, when you mentor somebody, to find those characteristics which are deep down and very personal as to whether they will stay the course through all the bumps that you go over.
That's right.
Thank you. Yes, hi.
Good morning. My name is Julia Boltz. I'm a human rights activist in the developing world, and I've actually just spent the past 5 years in Afghanistan where I'm building schools for girls. And although this is called women and American politics, the reality is, given your position, it's really women and world politics. And today, if you look at the globe, there are about 3 billion people who are living on less than $2 a day. Two-thirds of those individuals are women. There are about 90 million children who aren't in primary school in the developing world, and most of those are girls. And although they are your constituents and they can't vote, they're very much affected by our American foreign policy and our war on terrorism. So my comment to you today is, as a presenter here at the Ideas Festival, we each got to present our big idea. And my big idea is part of these Millennium Development Goals to get these 90 million children, both boys and girls, in primary school in the developing world. And as a voice of the voiceless, I know that you're torn between both representing your constituents, but the reality is you are the hope for those of us in the developing world, because you're the ones who really hold the purse strings and make the foreign policy calls both at the UN and the World Bank. And my encouragement to you all today is to just continue rising to the level of not simply representing your constituents, but really representing those 2 billion of us who have no voice, but desperately need you all.
So. Thank you for that comment. I mean, we've just seen a Pew Global Research study, which Madeline is very familiar with, which had some really discouraging information about attitudes around the world towards the way the United States uses its power, not towards Americans per se, but as I gather from reading the data, towards U.S. policy.
I am co-chair of this attitude survey with former Senator Danforth, and the numbers coming out are terrifying in terms of the way that the U.S. is viewed these days, and in any number of issues, but one that is germane to this point is that one of the big issues in the world, and one that I am very involved with now, and I think is actually the biggest problem in the world, is the gap between the rich and the poor. If we were all rich, it would be nice. If we were all poor, it would be too bad, but we'd all at least be the same. What is the problem now is that the poor know what the rich have as a result of information technology. And in that survey, it says that the U.S. is complicit in increasing that gap, that we have a lot of things, but we don't share. And so it is a major issue. The issue of women abroad is something that I just came back from Turkey. And if you think we have issues, I just met with many women who on this issue of how you run your life. They are arguing over the headscarf issue versus secularism. And it is viewed, when I made a statement, which was very American, which was that I would respect their right to do it. I find the veil issue a very complicated one, because to Americans it looks like you're hiding, and to them it's a matter of making a statement. That was not an acceptable statement to the secular women, because I had come down on the idea that it was all right for people to wear veils. But the majority of the people in the world are women. Women are not economically or politically empowered abroad, and I do think that is something that the U.S. needs to be concerned about. And I made women's issues central to American foreign policy, not because I'm a feminist, but because I was interested in the development of a variety of countries, and women have to be a part of it. I actually think that one of the disastrous policies, if I may be a little partisan, is the family planning policy at the moment. I don't see how we can say that we are helping women abroad when we are not willing to have people be able to make choices about their own lives. I do think that what you're doing is very, very important. And education, we know from facts that education for women in developing countries is one of the ways that everything can be changed. And I do think the hard part for Democrats when we take over everything, which we will, is that there is a huge deficit in our budget. And I, even as a foreign policy wonk, having been in New Orleans, I think there is, for want of a better word, a Katrina effect, where people actually say, you can't spend money on people that we never heard of if you are not spending money on development issues in the United States and poverty and health issues here. And I think that is going to be a... I agree with you totally, Diane, about bipartisanship, but I also think that we are going to have to deal with the interaction of domestic and foreign needs.
Let me just add one quick thing. This is the tragedy of the war, which runs around $100 billion a year to the tune of $500 billion so far. Let me ask people just a quick question. What percent of our budget do you think is spent on humanitarian assistance to other nations?
Less than 1%.
1%. Out there.
0.01.
No, actually it's about 0.8% goes for humanitarian assistance. It is very low. And that's why what the speaker was saying is so true, and what Madeline said is so right. If we don't do some of these things, we just, 20 years from now, those students, we don't build normal schools in the world. Those students that graduate from madrasas become the next generation of terrorists because they have no economic hope. If we don't have programs that go in to poverty-struck countries and are able to help people become economically upwardly mobile. So, I mean, this is a lot of food for thought here. And I just want to thank her for what she does because it's very impressive work.
If I could just add one more thing, though. We doesn't have to be government only. The person asking the question, I believe, gave up a lucrative law career to do this. I think you're the one who did that, yes, and as another Smith graduate. But Madeline chairs something called the National Democratic Institute. It's a wonderful organization. There's also an International Republican Institute, and they work hand in hand on a program called Partners in Participation. And I have been involved in some of their programs recently in Morocco and in Kuwait. And one of the things they do is they train North African and Middle Eastern women in advocacy skills and how to run for political office. And speaking at one of these trainings is amazing, because the women look so different from each other. There are some that are fully veiled, some that are fully Western, half and half, different languages, different colors, and all of them have the same hearts and the same strong heads, and they want to change the societies they live in. The reason I'm saying this is the funding for these groups is not all government, is not all federal funding. There's also private donations. There are NGOs that are very effective. I'm not trying to shirk responsibility, but I think that women who have succeeded in America and elsewhere do have an obligation to reach out internationally, and that's something we hadn't discussed, so I think it's a very, very good point.
I think we have time for one more question. You've been so patient. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sandy Stern, originally from New York, now Chevy Chase, Maryland. Let's just shift gears for one moment, if you will. Don't think about the candidates. Please think about the voter today. I'm so interested in what your response would be as to how much of the voter's mindset is influenced by the persona of the candidates as opposed to the issues. As opposed to the issues.
I think if I can just say something from a personal perspective, I have been dismayed so far this year as to how little focus there has been on issues. Okay. It has all been horse race. We all have been part of that, we in the media. It's early in the campaign, the earliest campaign, as we all know, that we've ever had, but I have never seen a campaign less focused on issues, where in debates you have multiple choice questions and people raising hands, and no drilling down on some of the issues that are not women's issues or men's issues. They're human issues that are going to overwhelm this country in terms of spending on entitlements and health care and trends for the future. And, you know, climate change is finally being addressed in a broader American conversation, but not really in the campaign. John, I don't know if you have a perspective on that. I know we're running out of time here, but I think the persona, the persona of the candidates has been the overwhelming focus, if you mean image, if you mean haircuts, gender, race,
clothing,
but not where people stand on individual issues. That's my own personal take. But
I agree. I mean, there's the debates have been sad. There's the candidates don't mind. The candidates complain a little bit, but they don't mind it either, because a lot of candidates don't want to have a two-hour debate on education policy because they don't have a third answer. So
some don't have a first answer.
Right. They don't. Yeah. Some don't have a first or a second. So it's not all our fault, but it's plenty our fault. But I would say one other thing. There's a debate among political scientists about, you know, the heart versus the head in terms of how people make their electoral choices. We'd all, I think, probably like everybody to sit down with position papers and votes senators took and their statements and kind of pour through it all and come up with a determination. But in the presidential elections I've covered, when you stop people on the street or in rallies over the years, the first things they talk about more often than not is, you know, something about healthcare, a specific policy choice, but a kind of more gut level feeling about the candidates. And there's a very big debate among political scientists about how much of a role this gut level feel plays in presidential politics. Now, of course, this is, you know, we always say that it's at every election, but this is a pretty serious election. And so if voters are ever going to look at candidates seriously and on the issues, you would hope this would be the time.
This has always been true, I think.
Well, I guess we are out of time, and I want to thank all of you and thank our sponsors for bringing us to